Chapter 34. Fawkes leaned over the ship's chart table, studying a set of blueprints, his hand making notations with a pencil. Two large men, well-muscled, the faces beneath their hard hats tanned and thoughtful, stood on either side of him. "I want her gutted, every compartment, every scrap of unnecessary tubing and electrical conduits, even her bulkheads." The man on Fawkes's left snorted derisively. "You've lost your gourd, Captain. Tear out the bulkheads and she'll break up in any sea rougher than a millpond." "Dugan is right," said the other man. "You can't gut a vessel this size without losing her structural resistance to stress." "Your objections are duly noted, gentlemen," Fawkes replied. "But in order for her to ride high, her draft must be cut by 40%. "I've never heard of gutting a sound ship just to raise her waterline," said Dugan. "What's the purpose of it all?" "You can scrap the armor as well as the auxiliary machinery," Fawkes said, ignoring Dugan's question. "While you're about it, you can see to the removal of the turret masts." "Come off it, Captain," snapped Lou Metz, the shipyard superintendent. "You're asking us to ruin what was once a damned fine ship." "Aye, she was a fine ship," agreed Fawkes. "In my mind, she still is. But time has passed her by. Your government sold her for scrap, and the African Army of Revolution bought her for a very special undertaking." "That's something else that rubs us wrong," said Dugan. "Trusting our ass so some bunch of nigger radicals can kill white people." Fawkes laid down the pencil and fixed Dugan with a rigid stare. "I don't think you people quite realize the economics of the situation," he said. "What the AAR does with the ship once it leaves your shipyard needn't concern your racial philosophies. What counts is that they pay my wages the same as they pay yours and those of your men, who, if my memory serves me, number 170. However, if you insist, I'll be happy to convey your sentiments to the officials in charge of the AAR Treasury. I feel certain they can find another shipyard that will prove more cooperative. And that would be a pity, particularly since their contract is the only one on your books at present. Without it, all 170 men on your crew would have to be laid off. I do not think their families will take it kindly when they find out your petty objections put their menfolk out of work." Dugan and Metz exchanged angry, defeated looks. Metz avoided Fox's eyes and gazed down sullenly at the blueprints. "Okay, Captain, you're calling the shots." There was a confidence born of long years of commanding men reflected in Fox's tight smile. "Thank you, gentlemen. Now that we've cleared the air of any misunderstandings, shall we continue?" An hour later, the two shipyard men left the bridge and made their way down to the main deck of the ship. "I can't believe I heard right," Metz mumbled numbly. "Did that lead-brained Scotsman actually order us to remove half the superstructure, the funnels, and the fore and aft gun turrets, and replace all with plywood sheeting painted gray?" "That's what the man said," Dugan replied. "I guess he figures by dumping all that weight he can lighten the ship by 15,000 tons. But why replace everything with dummy structures? Beats me. Maybe he and his black buddies expect to bluff the South African Navy to death." "And that's another thing," said Metz. "If you bought a ship like this to use in a foreign war, wouldn't you try and keep the deal under wraps? My guess is that they're going to blast Cape Town all to hell." "With dummy guns, no less," grunted Dugan. "I'd like to tell that overgrown bastard to take his contract and stuff it up his ass," Metz rasped. "You can't deny he's got us by the balls." Dugan turned and stared up at the shadowy figure behind the bridge windows. "Do you think he's ripe for a straitjacket?" "Nuts?" "Yeah. Crazy like a coyote, maybe. He knows what he's doing, and that's what bugs the shit out of me. What do you suppose the AAR really has in mind once they get the ship to Africa?" "I'll make book she never sees port," said Metz. "By the time we're through ripping her bowels out, she'll be so unstable she'll go belly up before she leaves Chesapeake Bay." Dugan eased his buttocks onto a massive capstan. He looked down the length of the ship. Her great mass of steel seemed cold and malevolent. It was as though she were holding her breath, waiting for some silent command to unleash her awesome power. "This whole act stinks," Dugan said finally. "I only hope to God we're not doing anything we'll regret." Fox examined the markings on a well-creased set of navigation charts. First, he computed the known velocity and fluctuations of the current, then the range of tidal conditions. Satisfied with the figures, he next traced a mile-by-mile course to his destination, memorizing every buoy, every beacon and channel marker, until he could picture them all in his mind's eye without confusion as to their exact sequence. The task before him seemed impossible. Even with precise analysis of every obstacle and its successful conquest, there were still too many variables that had to be left to chance. There was no way he could predict the weather on a given day still weeks away. The odds of colliding with another ship also reared their numerical heads. These unknowns he did not take lightly, and yet the possibility that he might be found out and stopped was refused entrance into his mind. He had even steeled himself to ignore any second thoughts from Duval, who might order the mission to be scrapped. At 10 minutes to midnight, Fox removed his glasses and rubbed his tired eyes. He took a small photo holder from his breast pocket and looked into the long-ago faces of his family. Then he sighed and propped the holder on a small packing crate set beside the cot he maintained in the control room of the ship. The first week he had slept in the captain's quarters, but the comfortable accommodations were gone now. Furnishings, facilities, even the bulkheads that once enclosed the cabin had been torched away. Fox undressed and slid his huge frame inside a sleeping bag, taking a final look at the photo. Then he clicked off the drop cord light and became smothered in the darkness of his loneliness and unrelenting hatred.